We've heard a lot of criticism over the past 48 hours of the media. What we got wrong, how cable networks have contributed to the deep political divide. Today on the 21st, we talk with the president of C-SPAN. It's the nation's only public affairs cable TV network, and we ask about its nonpartisan approach to political news coverage.
The idea is to put our viewers in the room. And yes, the model allows us to do that and take a very, agnostic approach to how events are covered and what events are covered.
Plus, we'll go through the state races that came to an end Tuesday night in Illinois.
This is the first time that a Hispanic person runs as a Democrat for any statewide office in the state of Illinois.
That's Susana Mendoza, Illinois' new comptroller, speaking Tuesday night. What does it mean in Springfield for the budget and budget stalemate? We'll go over all of that with Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky and Matt Dietrich from Reboot Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've heard so much about media in the past 48 hours, how much we got wrong, how much cable networks contributed to the bitter rancor and deep divide we're experiencing right now as a nation. Here's Stephen Colbert's take on election night.
And I think the people who designed our democracy didn't want us in it all the time. Informed, yes. Politicking all the time? I don't think so. They designed an election that was meant to confuse us and bore us a little bit. That's why the Electoral College exists. And C-SPAN.
We know that C-SPAN is the butt of a lot of jokes, just like public radio. But C-SPAN is the nation's only public affairs cable television network. The nonprofit network, which does not receive any government funding, started with one feed in 1979 from the floor of the House of Representatives. Today, it has three channels, a radio station, and of course, C-SPAN.org. It's available in 100 million American households. Rob Kennedy is its president. He's also a University of Illinois grad who's coming back here next week. He's speaking for a university event at the Chicago Cultural Center next Wednesday, and he joins us now from Washington. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the 21st, and welcome back to Illinois At Least Hits Airwaves.
Good morning, y'all. It's great to be here.
So, Rob, what's your perspective of how the media has covered this election? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, that's a big question, the day after the election. I know that at C-SPAN, as you mentioned, we are a public affairs channel. We're dedicated to showing events as they happen. We started with the House of Representatives, and we are the masters of long-form programming, which oftentimes does put us in the crosshairs of Stephen Colbert and others' jokes. But our purpose has always been to show these events as they occur from beginning to end. Very little editing, very little commentary. I think the other networks, both the broadcast networks and the cable networks, really travel to a different drum, if you will, travel to a different beat, which is the beat of commercial television, of advertising, of attracting viewers, and they approach things in entirely differently. They're in a competitive arms race, as it were, and it really evidenced itself in this particular campaign with a lot of horse race journalism, lots of dependency on polls and statistics and data. And I think there's going to be a lot written and a lot discussed over the next not only days and weeks, but months about how that influenced coverage and how that influenced voters. I think in many ways it's too early to say, and a lot of this will play out, I think, over the next several months.
And Rob, as you say, you all do sit in such a unique position in Washington. I know you've said in the past, C-SPAN is really about giving the public access to information that hasn't always been easily available outside of Washington. And as you said, you're a nonprofit organization. You don't have any funding from the government. You aren't a commercial model. Can you explain where your funding comes from?
Well, and that's kind of the beauty of how we can do what we do, is that there is no government money. We're a private 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we receive our money from the affiliates, the cable companies and the satellite companies who choose to carry our networks. There's no government requirement to carry C-SPAN, to provide it to customers. But instead, the companies who do carry us, companies like Comcast, DirecTV, Charter, they pay a monthly license fee to provide our networks. Works out to about 6 cents per home per month, and that funds our operations to the tune of $70 million. Because of this funding model, we don't take ratings. We don't have to sell advertising. We don't have to attract eyeballs. And that was really the beauty of the model that was established when C-SPAN was set up way back in 1979, when the House of Representatives first decided to go on television, and the cable industry, at that time there were no satellite companies, the cable industry decided to fund C-SPAN as a public service. So it's a very unique model, really doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, and it allows us to take this long-form approach to covering Congress, public affairs, and politics.
And do you think that kind of manages, because of that, you are able to stay out of Washington politics and simply broadcast Washington politics?
Well, I think it puts us in the unique role of being able to cover things in their entirety. A good example maybe from this past summer is the political conventions. There's a lot of coverage on the other networks, but we were one of the few, I think the only broadcast network that covered every speech at both conventions, and for that matter, third-party conventions, from beginning to end, and the material between the speeches. The idea is to put our viewers in the room. In the early days, when C-SPAN was started, there were just the three broadcast networks. They had the nightly newscast of 20 minutes, and much of what was happening in Washington was not seen by people in, for example, downstate Illinois or anywhere really outside of Washington. Our approach has been to cover events as if you are in the room. And yes, the model allows us to do that and take a very, I guess, agnostic approach to how events are covered and what events are covered.
I'm speaking with Rob Kennedy. He's the president and the co-chief operating officer of C-SPAN. And as you're saying this, Rob, I'm thinking about the congressional sit-down on the House earlier this year when the cameras were ordered shut off. And I should point out, this time it was by Republicans. This isn't the first time it's happened. Democrats did the same thing in 2008. And you all responded by using Periscope and other feeds from members on the floor. How did you decide to make that call?
That was a very proud day for us. The underlying fact of this, and you mentioned this, is that in many cases C-SPAN sends our own cameras to events to cover them, but that's not the case in the Congress. The cameras in each chamber, the House and the Senate, are controlled by the respective bodies. And on that particular day in June, the Republicans decided to shut off the cameras when the Democrats were protesting, and in this case, via a sit-in. Our producers, and initially we were surprised when the cameras went dark, but our producers on the spot quickly found that the Democrats were using Periscope and
Facebook
Live.
Mm-hmm.
To broadcast the sit-in. And that was an event happening on the floor, and we were able technically to turn it around and put it on air. So, and it was not as reluctant to use the word slick when it comes to C-SPAN, but it was certainly not the production quality that we normally see with handheld cameras on the floor. But we felt as something important that was going on in the House floor, that was a continuation of what was being discussed, that we should put that on air as members of Congress were having an event and broadcasting an event. So, and we've done single-party events before, whether it's Republican caucuses, Republican retreats, same for the Democrats. So there are certainly events, the political conventions, that are put on by one party. So in that sense, once we figured it out technically, we felt that it fit our mission of, again, putting people in the room, it's a public room, and seeing what was going on.
Well, and I think for me it was a watershed moment, how much different niche media such as C-SPAN really can grow your audience. And I imagine that's probably something you've spent a lot of time thinking about yourself. Do you think about growing bigger audiences for C-SPAN?
We think a lot about, in the changing environment, how to make our content both available and accessible. And one thing that we've noticed in looking at, as I said, we don't take ratings, but we do look at our web traffic. And sometimes very surprising events, or at least events that were unpredictable, make our traffic spike. Senator Murphy's filibuster in the Senate earlier in the spring generated a lot of traffic to our website. The sit-in did. Senator Cruz's and Senator Paul, when they've taken the floor in the Senate for long periods of time, that spikes our traffic. So the key there is, first of all, we have to be ready for that and let people know that it's available not only on television, but also on our website, on mobile devices. And these are the things we think about now that are different than when we just had the three television networks, which is, what's the impact of social media? How do we make our content available in the places that people are accessing their content, their news, their information in this modern digital era?
And speaking of social media, you guys had a video that went viral earlier this year, and I wanted to play part of that exchange because this had more than 2 million views on the Facebook page of one of the organizations that was featured in this conversation. Let's play a little bit of this. This is actually from one of your call-in shows.
I'm a white male, and I am prejudiced. The reason it is something I wasn't taught, but it's kind of something that I learned. I have these different fears, and I don't want my fears to come true, you know, so I try to avoid that. And I come off as being prejudiced, but I just have fears. What can I do to change, you know, to be a better American?
Heather McKee.
Thank you so much for being honest. And for opening up this conversation, because it's simply one of the most important ones we have to have in this country. So what can you do? Get to know black families who are not all and not even any majority are involved in crime and gangs. Turn off the news at night, because we know that actually nightly news and many media markets that have been studied actually over-represents African-American crime and under-represents crimes that happen by white people. Join a church if you are a religious person that is a black church or a church that is interracial. Start to read about the history of the African-American community in this country. Foster conversation in your family and in your neighborhood where you're asking exactly those kinds of questions. This fear of communities that we do not live near, we are still a very, very segregated country. Millions of white Americans live in places where they rarely see anyone of a different race. This fear and set of ideas that we only get from the worst possible news, it's tearing us apart. And we know that in order to be our name means the people of the nation, Demos. In order to be a Demos that is united across lines of race and class and gender and age, we have to foster relationships. We have to get to know who one another actually is. And we are always, I think, as Americans, surprised when we build relationships across race.
That was Heather McKee, president of the public policy organization Demos, responding to a caller on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Actually, it was last August. That video had more than 2 million views on Demos' Facebook page. Rob, as the president of C-SPAN, I wonder what you think that exchange says about your audience. I just thought it was such an interesting moment.
It was a remarkable moment, and I think there are two things to mention about this from our perspective. One, which is somewhat basic, is I mentioned earlier making our content available and accessible. And even though we're the network of long-form programming, we've built a website that records, in essence, everything that we've carried. And then we've created a set of tools around that to make it easy to find videos, to share them, to clip them, and to have our content become part of the discourse. So that's been a major strategic element of ours in the digital era. But the second thing, and I think something that's really relevant post-election, is that when C-SPAN started, we had a commitment to cover the Congress and public policy events from beginning to end without editing, as I mentioned. But another cornerstone of our network has always been viewer interaction. We were one of the first, if not the first, television call-in show when we started it in 1980, 1 year after C-SPAN was founded. And we took a page out of our radio friends' playbook to do viewer call-ins on the air, with the idea being that the American public should have an opportunity to talk with elected officials, policymakers, newsmakers, journalists, and to be heard. And we have been doing call-in programs since the beginning. And this was...
Rob, I'm sorry. I have to stop you here because we're going to take a break. But if we can just hold on that thought just for a second, we're going to take a break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Rob Kennedy. He's the president and co-chief operating officer of C-SPAN. He's also a U of I grad. That's why we're speaking to him. He's actually going to be in Chicago next week at the Cultural Center for a university luncheon that they're having in Chicago. Right before the break, we were just talking about a moment of that went viral last year on C-SPAN, a video that's got more than 2 million views on Facebook of a white caller who interacted with one of their African-American guests, Heather McGee, president of the public policy organization Demos. Rob, you were just saying before the break that one of the hallmarks of C-SPAN has to always have had a call-in show. And I wonder why you think, I wonder if you could just finish that thought and tell me why you also think that interaction, maybe even as we're thinking about the time that we're in after this election, why you think that's more important than ever?
Well, the call-in program, and this is true for ours and other networks, both radio, television, offers an opportunity not only for the callers to interact with our guests, again, members of Congress, journalists, people in the public eye, but also a great opportunity to listen to the American public and to understand their points of view day in and day out. An example that comes to mind is our call-in programs over the last year talking about this election and hearing supporters from of both candidates, really all candidates dating back to the primaries, express their views and why they were supporting one candidate or another. I'm reminded of in the late 1980s when, and especially coming up to the 1992 election when Ross Perot came on the public scene. And to some extent, this was a surprise, but we'd heard in our callers the appeal that his approach at the time had for them and how they expressed it. So I think what callers provide is, in these days, there's a lot of emphasis on data, and there's going to be a lot of analysis coming out of this election of sort of the quantitative models and what, who got it right and why it was wrong in so many cases. What the call-in programs do is really give us an opportunity to listen to the people and their feelings. It's a bit more qualitative, but it helps understand different perspectives. And I do think there's a danger in this day and age with our social media feeds and with news networks who take a certain point of view or a certain approach, that we don't listen to all sides. And I think that's one thing that's available on C-SPAN and that we benefit from, is being able to listen to just a number of different perspectives and begin to understand where people are coming from. It's not scientific, but it's a good look into the psyche of the American voter.
You all, as you mentioned, that you all operate on a voluntary relationship with Congress. As we're seeing more and more restrictions being put on media access to politicians, do you have any concerns that this access will change from administration to administration?
We're always watchful of that. I think that in general, the access has stayed constant in terms of consistent in with respect to where we can go, what we can shoot, what we can cover. The bigger question is how often will members of an administration or members of Congress make themselves available for interactions with the press, press conferences, that sort of thing. Every administration will take a different approach, so we'll have to see how the new administration handles that. Congress in general has always made themselves available, and that is consistent from whether one party's in the minority, one party's in the majority. And our approach to coverage gives the minority party always an equal access. Obviously, the one area that is not available to us and is the Supreme Court.
Right, and I know you've repeatedly requested televising Supreme Court hearings. I guess, any chance you think that will happen anytime soon?
I don't see that happening anytime soon in terms of live video coverage from inside the court. We will continue to press our case. We continue to think it's important to have access to the oral arguments of the court. In fairness to the court and the Chief Justice, we now get audio recordings of the arguments at week's end, and that has given insight into the actual nature of the arguments. It's been very valuable, but it's not the same as being in the room, and the public can line up and attend an oral argument, and we'd like to be able to show that on our networks.
One last question for you, Rob. You were a University of Illinois Engineering Department graduate. Did you think you would ever end up becoming the president of C-SPAN?
No. My story there is I took a journalism course when I was at the University of Illinois, and it was too hard. I dropped it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well,
most people don't normally say that. I will tell you that, Rob.
I know, but my family knows, so I've got to be full disclosure. And they may be listening. So,
your family in Springfield might be listening. Okay.
Yes. So I got to be full disclosure on that one. No, I didn't. I was very fortunate in my career. I worked in the cable industry early on. I had the benefit of meeting Brian Lamb in 1981, and he asked me to come work C-SPAN just a few years later. So no, but my university training put me in good shape. Once an engineer, always an engineer in terms of your approach to problems, your approach to management. So I give the university a lot of credit. It's a great school. WILL is one of the great organizations that's connected with the university and has been providing a great public service to downstate Illinois and for years, and hopefully that can extend now through online and other means of distribution to the entire state.
Oh, well, thanks for that. Rob Kennedy is the president of C-SPAN, as you've also just heard, of course, a University of Illinois graduate. He's going to be back in Illinois. He's in Chicago next Wednesday at the Chicago Cultural Center for a luncheon sponsored by the university. Rob, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us 2 days after the election for your take on everything. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Niala. Enjoyed it. Good luck.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've heard reports of incidents happening at the University of Illinois' campus yesterday after the presidential election. Numerous students complaining of racist attacks. Joining us now is Julie Dowling. She's with the Inclusive Illinois Committee. She teaches in the Department of Latino Studies at the University of Illinois, where she's an associate professor. Julie Dowling, thank you for taking the time to be with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Julie, I understand we've heard numerous reports of different incidents that have happened. What have your students said to you about what's transpired in the past 24 hours?
Yes. So my first class yesterday was at 9:30 in the morning, and one of my students, as we tried to begin class, the students were very distraught. One of them said that a friend of hers was riding on the bus and saw a Trump supporter flash a knife at a Muslim student on the bus. And so she herself didn't witness it, but said her friend had. And the students also had experienced themselves having had Trump supporters yell things and shout at them. And this kind of escalated later in the day. I heard more and more stories from students in my afternoon class of what had transpired at the university quad earlier in the day.
And what specifically did they say? Mm-hmm.
They complained that Trump-supporting students had yelled things at students of color as they were walking on campus, and that this had led to a, sort of an altercation, and that other students had come to sort of to their aid and sort of formed a human chain of solidarity to protect the students. And this had gone on for some time. I understand that there were multiple verbal altercations on the quad involving this, and one of our faculty called the university police.
And I do know, in regards to that one incident you said about the bus, the university did respond saying that they take it very seriously, they're looking into it, that they were in contact with the university police department, and said that the university police department has said that there hasn't been any reports of incidents and asked people to help out by calling 911 if they see something happening, and they added that student safety is their number one priority.
I encouraged the student in my class to please tell her friend to report that. And so I'm hopeful that perhaps that student will come forward. I understand it was in the early morning. So my class is at 9:30, and it was an early morning bus coming into campus is what she had said.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess what sounds like from what you're hearing from students is concern, particularly among students of color, about the way that they've been treated in the past 24 hours.
Yes. You know, they're feeling very fearful on campus, and feeling though as though they want to be assured of their personal safety and to have the university take some action, you know, to take a stand against this. And so I understand that the university is working on a statement now and that the university police have been contacted. And so I'm hopeful that there'll be, you know, some healing that will take place on our campus, and that students will be, you know, informed that while it is okay for them to hold their political beliefs that may be different, that threatening and intimidating other students is not appropriate and won't be tolerated on our campus. That is my hope and my wish for what will come out of this in terms of university response.
And I know that the University Chancellor Robert Jones did send out an email yesterday evening that went to the entire community saying, on the day after the election, we have a chance to take a breath, look around, and remind ourselves that we are a community defined by how we treat one another and by our willingness to focus on how we move forward together. And he said, we don't have to agree with each other to respect one another. We don't have to be friends to work together towards a better future. We're in this together. And there's no place better suited to demonstrate that what this looks like in practice than our university. That's from Robert Jones, the University of Illinois Chancellor, in an email he sent to the community. What else would you like to see happen, Julie?
Definitely. And that, my understanding from my communications with the administration last night and this morning is that statement was written before these incidents were made public yesterday afternoon. And so, because that came out, originally it came out on his blog early afternoon as all the stuff was going on. And so they're working on a separate statement, because that obviously was more of a general statement about post-election, right? You know, like just kind of like, let's all come together following our election, you know, and try to get along type of statement. But it doesn't really address anything that was going on, because they were not, as of that moment, aware of what had been happening on campus. And so they're working on something, what I hope, again, will be a statement that this kind of behavior is not acceptable. You know, you have a right to wear a Trump, you know, T-shirt or a button or something on campus. You don't have a right to yell, intimidate, or, you know, physically or verbally threaten other students.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of any incidents this morning?
I'm not on campus as of yet. I'm about to head in, and so I have not, but I taught both at 9:30 a.m. yesterday and 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and at both times, students had multiple stories.
Questions for you. What resources are there for students who don't feel safe on campus?
Well, what we did yesterday in our department in Latino Studies is we held solidarity hours from noon to 1:30 and from 3:30 to 5, where we had food and had students come in, and we had faculty and staff there to help facilitate a dialogue, to talk about what they were experiencing, to encourage them to, again, report these incidents, which we're working on right now, as well as to seek, you know, counseling support on campus. The Gendered Women's Studies also held solidarity hours yesterday from 4 to 6, and La Casa Cultural Latina, which is our cultural house on campus, held an event last night for students at 7 p.m. So there's been a number of events, I don't think that's even all of them that I'm listing, that took place yesterday as the campus was starting to respond to the election and to what happened and to reports of threats on campus. And so, you know, different units on campus are stepping up to try to help and support their students. There's talk now of possibly having a dialogue or something hosted that will help bring people together. But again, I think what's important that needs to come out, especially after in light of what happened yesterday, is going to be a strong statement. This kind of behavior, the threatening behavior, is not acceptable. And assuring students that the university backs and supports them and prioritizes their personal safety.
Julie, unfortunately, we've heard the incidents you've detailed. This is not an isolated incident to the University of Illinois campus. We've seen reports in the past 24 hours of this happening all across the country. And I wonder, what does this tell you more broadly about the work that you think that needs to happen across Illinois and across the country right now?
There's so much. I mean, it's right now, I think so many of us are just grief-stricken about the outcome of the election and what this means, and foresaw the possibility of this kind of behavior escalating, because it certainly didn't just begin now, right? But having it escalate after the election, because students feeling more emboldened and, you know, and able to act in this way because they feel like, oh, the majority is with me and the future president is with me, and feeling as though they can behave in that way with that kind of support. And so I think that, you know, we need to organize, we need to take action to protect people, to speak out as these incidents are happening, and people need to let people know that it's not acceptable and that we need to sort of organize ourselves to come together. I think maybe a larger event here, even on campus, that could bring groups together to support each other across the board, racial, ethnic minorities, women, LGBTQ community, et cetera, would be a really good avenue to take here just locally in terms of action.
Do you, I wonder what protection you think there is for people who have been victimized if they come forward? I know that we've seen specifically here some reports on social media that Muslim women aren't reporting incidents because they're afraid of the police.
Yes.
We've seen a lot of, so I wonder what you would offer to that.
You know, I think that there's got to be ways set up. I don't know if the university or local police have avenues for reporting anonymously for those who wish to report that an incident happened, but they don't feel as though their personal safety is in jeopardy now, but they want action to be taken for them to be able to report things anonymously if they're afraid of the police and don't want to have their names used. I think that holds a lot of people back from wanting to report an incident. Quite honestly, even as, you know, as a faculty member wanting to talk and speak about things that my students are saying, when I posted this on Facebook last night, I originally didn't realize when I made the post public for people to share that then that would mean that the comments was open. And so I started getting angry messages from, and it's fearful. I was like, I started making sure that everything on my page was private, and that, you know, and you start to feel nervous in reporting things, even reporting things that didn't happen to you, but that happened to other people, that you could become a target yourself. And I think that fear, you know, that's going on there for people is very, very real. And so whatever the police, you know, campus police, local police can do to help people feel comfortable coming forward to talk about issues of sort of hate crimes and these kinds of things will be very important, whether it's, you know, anonymous ways of doing that, apps on your phone, something like that.
Julie Dowling is an associate professor in Latina Studies at the University of Illinois, part of Inclusive Illinois Committee. Professor Dowling, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We just heard from University of Illinois Professor Julie Dowling about racist incidents at the university yesterday. We wanted to also add a statement that we received from the University of Illinois Police Department. Spokesman Patrick Wade told us that the police department haven't received any formal reports of hate crimes or threats related to the election, but that one of their officers did respond to a call about a man yelling on the quad yesterday, although it didn't result in a formal report. University police added they recognize this is a, quote, high-stress time for many people and that they're reaching out to various groups on campus. Officers are already paired with various cultural houses and other campus organizations through the department's Adopt a Cop program, and they're also reaching out to offer assistance. And they added, quote, we want to be part of the campus community that promotes civil discourse and understanding for all of our students, faculty, and staff. Yesterday's show was so much overshadowed by the results of the presidential election, with Donald Trump elected to become the 45th president of the United States. We promised that we would focus on results of state and local races, and we want to do that now. We're joined by two political reporters who have been our frequent guests on this journey leading up to the election. Matt Dietrich is the editor of Reboot Illinois. He's on the line from Chicago. Amanda Vinicky is our Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief, and she's in Springfield. Matt, Amanda, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with the comptroller's race. Democrat Susana Mendoza defeated Republican Leslie Munger for comptroller. This race was widely viewed as a proxy between Governor Rauner and House Speaker Madigan. Matt, remind us how much money was spent on this race.
Well, you had Leslie Munger received, I'm looking right now at her financial reports, and she had received somewhere on the lines of $9 million for this race. And to put that into perspective, I went back and looked at when her predecessor, Judy Bar Topinka, the late Judy Bar Topinka, was running for re-election in the comptroller's race back in 2014. If you take the period from the January of 2013 until the election of 2014, for Judy Bar Topinka, she spent about somewhere on the lines of $1 million. If you look at the same amount for Leslie Munger, she spent along the lines of $10 million for that same period from January of 2015 through November of 2016. So it was a huge, huge amount of money that had just poured in and just showed how much more important this office was viewed this time around than it had been back in the 2014 election. I mean, another funny figure, not funny, but another interesting figure is that for Leslie Munger, during the time from the time that she was appointed until the election this week, she had received 572 donations, and the average amount was $17,699. You take the same rough time period, January 2013 through Judy Bar Topinka's last election in November 2014, she received 801 donations, but only an average of $1,473, so
wow.
More than tenfold difference.
That's remarkable. And Matt, as you mentioned, Judy Bar Topinka, I should note to everybody that Susana Mendoza, wore a red pantsuit on Tuesday night for political watchers throughout the state. That's the power suit did belong to Judy Bar Topinka. They were very close, and I know her son invited Susana Mendoza to take some of his mother's belongings before he had an estate sale. Amanda, if you could weigh in here, what does the comptroller even do, and how much does this race really matter when we're talking about how much money that was spent on this?
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons why this race was more significant than last time around, and part of that is just bragging rights. Part of it is also when you have part of Rauner's power, and why I think Republican legislators have been in lockstep behind him is because they know he has a whole lot of money, and he'll use it against him, as he did in a primary for a downstate senator who didn't vote his way, or he'll use it to help them in future campaigns. So this is sort of protecting the woman that he had appointed. And then also it's because the comptroller, in Munger's case, was able to, I think, make the governor's life easier. Now that a Democrat will be there, she can make the governor's life harder, especially if Illinois continues to wade through this budget impasse. The comptroller, of course, is the one who writes the state's checks. So Munger had generally put the blame on everyone or on the legislature for not coming up with a budget. She, and Mendoza, I think, is going to put that blame. She already has used her voice to put that blame on the governor. And further, the comptroller can decide at this time, when Illinois doesn't have enough money to cover all of its bills, which gets paid first, which goes to the end of the stack. And therefore, we don't know exactly what goes on, but presumably there are conversations between the comptroller's office and the governor's office saying, hey, we got a call. Can you do this? We think this is going to be kind of a PR emergency here, or somebody's really hurting. Instead, Mendoza won't presumably be having those conversations, at least in a, hey, how can I help you out, governor? She could use that against him. So there are, I think, a host of reasons why this is important politically and practically.
And as you mentioned that, and we talk about the money poured into that race, we should put this against the context of the other races that we're talking about. We saw that Republicans picked up 6 seats. Is that correct, Amanda, between the House and the Senate yesterday?
Yeah, a net gain of 6, 4 mm-hmm. in the House and 2 in the Senate.
And as we're sort of the dust settling, I saw a comment from a longtime state lawmaker, Barbara Flynn Curry, a Democrat. I don't think the election results made a difference in Springfield relationships besides the fact that they might have made people crabby. That's House Majority Leader Barbara Flynn Curry, represents a Chicago Southside District. What are you hearing today in Springfield, Amanda? Are people crabby? How do you think that this election is being talked about now?
You know, I do think that there is going to be a lot of crabby. There is, any time after an election, you have a lot of people who are very tired from having spent months knocking on doors, making phone calls, fundraising. You have some less than crabby people that won tight races that I think are feeling relieved. But obviously, there have been a lot of harsh words uttered, and the most crabby of all may be House Speaker Michael Madigan, given that he was the subject of so many of these negative ads. Rauner himself was too. Let's remember, there was a group that came late into the season called Lyft that is run by Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston, who tried to tie Rauner and Trump and say that it is kind of all of Illinois' issues are Rauner's fault versus Madigan's. But much as money went into that, I think it was about $8 million in the end, but there was far more money spent by Rauner to really try and hurt Madigan. And that could be a factor, I think, going forward, is you look to the speaker's willingness to really converse, compromise, and deal with the governor after all that.
Matt, as we think about that, go ahead, Matt, if you want to weigh in.
Well, I was going to say it's one of the fascinating things about those results is the different ways in which both sides interpreted them. We had the House Republican leader Jim Durkin, of course, issued a statement that said clearly the Republicans have cut into the Democratic supermajority in the House. This is a sign that the Democrats, it's time to come over and talk about Bruce Rauner's reform agenda. Meanwhile, House Speaker Michael Madigan puts out a statement saying, clearly the people of Illinois want a Democratic majority in the House and in the General Assembly, and therefore it's time for Governor Rauner to put down his turnaround agenda and come to the bargaining table. So both sides have played it as in their favor, that they won but based on Tuesday's results.
Well, and it's sort of a continuation of both sides living in their own red and blue worlds rather than, I guess the question is, are either of those sides living within the state of Illinois where we still have a huge budget problem? Yesterday when we spoke with David Yepsen, former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, he surfaced again the conversation and the possibility of the fact that there may never be a budget
right
while Governor Rauner is in office. And that's my final question for both of you. Matt, if you want to start, I mean, what does all of this mean for the budget? This is now, the election is over. This is when we're supposed to be starting to work on this.
Yes, but now, it would have seemed absurd if you would have said in the summer of 2015 that we will not have a state budget even after the 2016 election. Well, now that we're after the 2016 election, it doesn't seem quite so absurd to say we may not have a budget throughout Rauner's first term. And I really think what is shaping up, and I hope it doesn't come to this because this is ridiculous the way things are going, but what I think is shaping up, and based on those two statements I just referenced, is both sides are content that they are going to hang on and dig in, and no matter how bad things get on the outside, and you know, you're there on the University of Illinois campus, so you're seeing some direct effects of this. I think both sides are gambling that no matter how bad things get on the ground, the other side's going to get blamed for it and ultimately will win politically and will prevail, and we're going to go to the mat on that. I think it's a possibility. I really do. Now, having said that, I just got a notice, an email notice popped up that Governor Rauner is calling for a meeting with the legislative leaders on Monday in Springfield. Now, we've seen those meetings happen before. We saw them happening beginning last December, and there was a lot of fanfare and no progress whatsoever. Whether that nets any progress in advance of next week's session, who knows? But I do think it's a real possibility that both sides are going to dig in and say, we don't care how bad things fall apart, because we know that the other side's going to get blamed and ultimately will win.
Amanda, can you give us a preview? So it looks like we have this meeting on Monday. When does session? When are they back in session? Any sense of what will be on the agenda immediately?
Sure. Well, not necessarily a meeting on Monday yet. The governor's office, I think, wants out there that he has extended an invitation.
So he's asking for a meeting, but we haven't heard an answer yet. Good clarification.
Exactly.
Thanks,
there may not actually be one. And I have spoken with legislators, and they have said, don't expect a whole ton to happen. Veto session resumes on Wednesday. There aren't a whole load of overrides to deal with. There's one on automatic voter registration, a couple regarding what workers, say those that help the disabled, will be paid. So those are the issues. But you do have, in a way, it of course is not a lot of time, particularly for the entities that depend on government funding when the state budget runs out at the end of this calendar year for things to get started and have something in place for January. But in terms of how legislators operate, which is generally pretty darn last minute, that is a ways away. So not a whole lot of expectation, I think, that things are going to get going immediately, other than presumably a lot of these conversations with the media, maybe some behind closed doors, and presumably a lot of press releases going back and forth or public statements anyway.
Amanda, any chance we'll see any crazy action by any lame duck lawmakers in this veto session? I don't know.
Not during the veto session. Again, it's still, I think, pretty early, pretty raw. When you more see that will be in January, just before the new General Assembly is inaugurated. That's when we consider it the, quote, lame duck session. You're right, they are lame ducks as of now, but again, they're more prone to taking action last minute. I don't know about crazy action. I think the wisdom would be that if you're going to have any sort of tax increase, do it now so that it is, first of all, farthest away from the next election, and second of all, because you have all of these people who no longer need to present themselves before voters, who therefore are more free to vote for a tax increase if they believe that, in fact, is warranted or needed. But until you have that release from the higher-ups, you're not going to have any vote on that. So really, again, this is contingent, I think, on Madigan and Rauner and wherever their relationship and political paths are at.
Amanda, one quick question for you. Any sense, you mentioned, and I think it's a very good practical point, how tired people are. I imagine there's not much conversation happening in Springfield until next week.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you don't have any legislators really here. They're still probably in their districts, maybe, like I said, practically just sleeping, seeing the families that they haven't seen anywhere besides in the campaign trail or like at a parade for a while. Things are pretty quiet around here. But yeah, they'll start getting busy again. The hallways of the Capitol will fill. I've got a bunch of press conferences already beginning to filter in for Tuesday.
That's Amanda Minicky, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief, a force of nature. Amanda, I'm glad you still have the energy to keep going after this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks also to Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois, and someone who's been with us checking in on politics and doing all the fact-checking through their partner, PolitiFact Illinois, during this election season as well. Matt, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you, Nyla.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're going to take a break from politics. We're going to speak with Chicago native Margo Jefferson about her memoir, Negroland. It's about growing up among the city's black elite in the 1950s and 60s. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, if you want to send us feedback, give us a call, leave us a voicemail, send us an email. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about, including Chicago Tribune stories about politics and the budget stalemate. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.